but he's going to move to Baylor University in just a few weeks. And so he comes to us today to talk about planetary science and aiming for heavens.
Thanks. I became aware of ASA through a recently launched group of Christians in planetary science. I'm talking near the maximum volume that I can, but I'll try to speak up a little bit more. But yeah, there's a small group of Christians in planetary science that recently started, and I found out about ASA through that. And I wanted to come and talk about my own planetary science research. I think this talk will be a little heavier on the science side of things, although I'll try to keep it from being too technical. And then I'll share briefly about my perspective of being a follower of Jesus in this field. So one thing you should know about planetary scientists, no parent is allowed to have a favorite child, but every planetary scientist has a favorite planet. You can ask Roger Weens, who will be giving an afternoon talk. I'm sure he has his own opinions, and mine will become obvious very quickly. So you have the Earth, and you have its two neighboring planets, Mars and Venus. Which one is more like Earth? Well, in terms of size, Venus is about the same size, and Mars is only a tenth the mass of Earth. Venus is closer in orbit. If you were to stand on Venus, you would weigh about the same. The composition of Venus is very similar to Earth's composition. When NASA was busy sending astronauts to the moon, Russia, or the Soviet Union, decided that it would effectively claim Venus as its planet. So they sent a number of landers there and found basaltic compositions on the surface of Venus, which is what the Earth's ocean crust is made of. And moreover, those compositions were derived from a peridotite parent composition. So in other words, Venus's mantle is also similar to Earth's mantle. And finally, Venus is relatively active geologically. There's some very new evidence for recent lava flows, and there's tectonics and fault lines. So I am short-selling Mars a little bit. There are plenty of reasons to be excited about Mars, but I just want to highlight the fact that in many ways, Venus is Earth's sister planet. And so in some of these basic statistics, we've discovered thousands of exoplanets, planets orbiting other stars, in the past several years. And so far, none of them is more like Earth in terms of size and distance from the host star. And yet, Venus is a completely different planet. It's 870 degrees on the surface. The Russian landers, the longest lived one lasted 2 hours before it succumbed to the heat. The atmospheric pressure is 90 some times greater. Rain, sulfuric acid, there's no water whatsoever, it's bone dry. There's some weird things about the atmosphere, where the atmosphere rotates faster than the planet itself. There's no core dynamo, which is what creates a planetary magnetic field. The root cause of all of these may very well be Venus's strange geology. Venus doesn't have plate tectonics, but rather has something called a stagnant lid. This cuts off the carbon cycle, which allows volcanic gases to accumulate in the atmosphere. The lack of plate tectonics reduces the heat flux out of the planet, which may explain why Venus has no core dynamo. Without a core dynamo and a magnetic field, the solar wind can strip away hydrogen from the atmosphere and make the planet lose all of its water. So why bother studying such an inhospitable place? Well, the theme of my talk comes from a quote by C.S. Lewis, "Aim for heaven and you'll get Earth thrown in." And that's intended in a theological context, but I like to use that as a double entendre. The things we learn about Venus help us understand why our own planet is the way it is. For example, scientists discovered the chemistry of the ozone layer while they were studying Venus's atmosphere. And I was a little late in getting here because I was talking to Catherine Hayhoe after the plenary, and she pointed out to me that for climate modeling, you create models and then you have to match them to things that you observe. And Venus is one of the few other examples of a climate that we know of that you can try to model. In our search for habitable exoplanets, Venus can help us understand what exactly it is that makes a habitable planet. And the answer is probably in the details. In terms of biblical significance, Venus is the only planet other than Earth mentioned in the Bible. The ancients didn't distinguish between planets and stars, other than noting that planets are stars that move. Venus is closer to the sun than us, so it's always within 45 degrees of the sun. As a result, it's often visible either just before morning or just after evening. And this earned Venus the name of the morning star. And if you ever get a chance to see a sunrise on the East Coast, you might see it over the ocean. And it really is beautiful. Isaiah talks about the morning star. How you have fallen from heaven, morning star, son of the dawn. You have been cast down to earth, you who once laid low the nations. And this is a reference to King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. As is often the case in the Bible, there are layers of significance here. Jesus says that he saw Satan fall down from heaven like lightning. And in that context, this verse is often interpreted to be a reference to Satan as well as Nebuchadnezzar. The King James translation uses the word Lucifer from the Latin Vulgate, and the etymology of that is lux, meaning light, and fera, meaning bearer, or the bringer of light. And that refers to the way that Venus precedes the dawn. So in modern times, people use the word Lucifer as sort of a synonymous name with Satan, but the original meaning wasn't so negative. Prior to his fall, Satan was a glorious creature, like Nebuchadnezzar, but they both fell from grace spectacularly because of their pride. There's a reference in 2 Peter, you will do well to pay attention to this message, as to a light shining in a dark place, until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your heart. And finally, a reference in Revelation. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright morning star. Again, as is often the case in the Bible, there are layers of significance there. Jesus is the true and better morning star. While Nebuchadnezzar and Satan both strive to glorify themselves, Jesus did not consider divinity something to be exploited, but instead made himself a servant and humbled himself to the point of death on the cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue confess that he is Lord. But there's also the metaphor of the morning star as a beacon that precedes the dawn, the way that Jesus is a herald for the new heavens and the new earth. And 1 John says, the darkness is passing and the true light is already shining. So Venus is an interesting planet. It's crucial for understanding why Earth is the way it is, and for understanding the diversity of Earth-like planets that might exist in our galaxy. So my research on Venus is focused on understanding the inner workings of the planet. One major unresolved question is, without plate tectonics, how do continents form on a planet like Venus? Venus has a few major continents with thick crust, and there are two competing theories for how they would have formed. The first theory is that continents form over upwelling plumes in the mantle. Decompression of the upwelling plumes creates melted magma, which trickles upward and thickens the crust. The second theory involves a downwelling in the mantle. As the mantle sinks downward, it causes the crust to pile up like converging conveyor belts and makes this thick crust. They essentially make opposite predictions about what's going on in the mantle. So we could make progress if we could look into the mantle of the planet. And in a sense, we can. In order to do that, I need to take you back to the 19th century and a man named John Henry Pratt. Pratt was a chaplain with the British East India Company who penned a number of theological writings, including some on faith and science, and devoted his life to honoring God. But Pratt's second passion was applying mathematical principles to the study of Earth. One day while Pratt was living in Calcutta, he met the Surveyor General of the Great Trigonometrical Survey. This is an ambitious project to precisely survey the entire Indian subcontinent. But there was a problem. The results were inconsistent near the Himalayas. They eventually figured out that plumb lines were being deflected towards the mountains. So the Surveyor General asked John Pratt if he could explain this, and Pratt said, "Aha, according to Sir Isaac Newton and his law of gravitation, any large mass will produce a gravitational pull. Therefore, you would expect a plumb line to be deflected towards a mountain range as massive as the Himalayas." Thus was born the technique of using gravity to study the crust of the Earth. And to this day, this is the best tool we have at our disposal for looking inside planets in the solar system. And I'll talk about that much more in a second. But it wasn't quite so easy for Pratt. They eventually figured out with astronomy that there was a deflection toward the Himalayas, but it was much less than the law of gravitation would have expected. The real plumb line deflection was just somewhere splitting the difference between the expected plumb angle without the mountain and the plumb angle that you would expect with the massive Himalayas. So this is a puzzle. Why would gravitational attraction from a mountain be less than what Newton predicted? Pratt eventually realized that while the mountain range does have some extra mass, it must be accompanied by a deficit of mass underground. And this became the principle of isostasy. Not only did it explain the observation, it kind of makes sense. If you go sufficiently deep in the Earth's mantle, the mantle behaves like a fluid and it can't support lateral variations in pressure. And as a result, every column in the Earth's interior needs to have roughly the same amount of mass. The most intuitive analogy for isostasy comes from an iceberg. The mass of the ice equals the mass of the water that it displaced. A mountain range can be thought of as an iceberg's tip, and the mass above sea level has to be balanced by the buoyancy below sea level. So fast forward to the present day. Most of what we know about the inside of Earth comes from seismology, either from tomography or seismic reflections. But there are currently no functioning seismometers on other planets. The next best tool for learning about the inside of a planet is the slight variations in the strength of gravity, like the one that John Pratt observed next to the Himalayas. We have information about gravity fields around other planets because of the way we communicate with spacecrafts. NASA's Deep Space Network consists of three stations in California, Spain, and Australia that send and receive data from spacecrafts anywhere in the solar system. And these signals are sent at specific radio frequencies. Now, the motion of the spacecraft relative to Earth creates a Doppler effect. And everyone here has probably experienced a Doppler effect when an ambulance goes by. The siren has a certain pitch as it's coming towards you, and then right after it passes you, the pitch drops. The motion of the ambulance either compresses or stretches the sound wave, and the same principle holds for radio communication. The slight changes in radio frequency indicate changes in velocity. Changes in velocity indicate acceleration. Acceleration comes from gravity, which comes from the uneven distribution of mass inside a planet. A planet's crust contains a disproportionate amount of the lighter elements, like silicon, calcium, aluminum, and oxygen, so it's less dense than the mantle. As a result, the weight of a plateau tends to be supported by a buoyant crustal root, like in the iceberg analogy. In geophysics terminology, we talk about mass anomalies. So there's a positive mass anomaly associated with the plateau. There's extra mass there. And then there's a deficit of mass associated with the buoyant crustal root. And these are equal and opposite mass anomalies. But the spacecraft is a little bit closer to the plateau than it is to the buoyant root. And so they somewhat cancel out, but you end up with a slightly positive gravity anomaly, as shown on the top. And this is what Pratt observed with the Himalayas. The pull of gravity is slightly stronger over the mountain range. But it is somewhat less than you might expect. If the compensating mass anomaly is deeper in the mantle of the planet, you still have the equal and opposite mass anomaly, but the mass deficit here is now so far away that we barely feel it. And we mostly just feel the gravity from the plateau. That makes the gravity anomaly large relative to the surface topography. The greater this depth of compensation, the larger the gravity anomaly relative to the topography. The most recent NASA mission to Venus, from which we have all our data, was a spacecraft called Magellan, which went in the early 1990s. And it found topography is shown on top, and then the gravity field. So in the topography, you can see that Venus does have some things that look like continents. Ishtar Terra up at the top, Opta Regio, Thetis Regio, and a number of smaller ones. And then we also have the geoid, which is a gravitational equipotential surface. And to make a long story short, a high geoid means the same thing as a stronger gravitational attraction. Here I sampled points on the globe for topography in the geoid, and I made a scatter point, a scatter plot. Each point corresponds to the topography on the x-axis and the geoid on the y-axis in one location. For the planet as a whole, you can see that there is generally a positive correlation between the gravity and the topography, which is what we expect. But we can pick out two trends. There's a shallower trend associated with crustal roots and a steeper trend associated with mass anomalies in the mantle at a few hundred kilometers depth. So in a 2013 paper, I used Green's functions for dynamic flow to create two maps. The top one is a map of crustal thickness, and the bottom one is a map of mass anomalies in the mantle. In the crustal thickness, you can see that the areas that were continents have thicker crust. They have roots of crust going down into the mantle. And then on the bottom, you have, plotted this with red for low mass anomaly, for negative mass anomaly. And so you can think of that in terms of a hot, thermally expanded mantle. So red is basically the same as hot and blue is cold. And the red hot stuff is upwelling and pushing on the surface of the planet. This is a visualization from another scientist using my crustal thickness map, as if you were swimming in the mantle and looking up at the underside of the crust. And from this perspective, you can see the roots of the continents, almost like keels of a ship. So this plot is has one of the most important implications for the two maps that I showed. So I want to spend a minute trying to explain it. On the x-axis, I plotted crustal mass. So this is the integrated volume of crust on some of the planet, some of the continents. So all of the continents have an excess amount of crust. On the y-axis, that is the mantle mass anomaly. And most of them are below zero on the y-axis, meaning there is a deficit of mass in the mantle underneath these continents. Looking at one in particular, this is Thetis Regio. In the left on the subplot, that's the topography. You can see it's a broad swell about 3,000 miles across. In the crustal thickness, you can see that the central section has a deep root of crust, but there's also this broad low-density anomaly in the mantle from a mantle that's buoyant and pushing up on the surface of the crust. And so this is generally true for all of the major continents we see on Venus, and this supports the upwelling hypothesis of the ones that I talked about at the beginning of this talk. So to conclude, I've talked enough about my research, and I want to take a minute to talk about what a faith in Jesus means for someone in this field. The first comment I have is that science is surprisingly similar to faith in a certain sense, and I want to explain what I mean by that. Everything I know about the inner workings of Venus came from a little blinking light in the sky 2 decades ago. when the Messenger spacecraft transmitted its data. I've never been there in person, and I've certainly never dug underground. We have the same commission as Christians, who will never see Jesus in the flesh during our natural lives. And this kind of faith is difficult, and often it's only possible through a gift from God. I participated in science team meetings for two robotic missions to the moon, and I had a surreal experience after one of them when I walked outside and I saw the full moon hanging in the sky. And it's not that I didn't believe the moon existed, it was just that we'd spent so much time thinking about the moon in a theoretical sense that I briefly had trouble thinking of it as a real place and not just as an abstract concept. And I suspect it can be the same way with theology sometimes. So disciplines like mine are an exercise in comprehending truths beyond our senses. The second comment is that planetary science encourages long-term mindsets in the same way that the gospel cultivates a kingdom mindset. I've met several astronauts, and each of them will say that traveling above the atmosphere and looking at the full circle of the Earth dramatically changed his or her worldview. It'll probably be a generation or two before we establish a colony on another planet, and it might be 1,000 years before we venture to another star system. But thinking in these long-term horizons is incredibly valuable for society. As C.S. Lewis put it, the Christians who did the most for the present world were precisely those who thought the most of the next. So there are some parallels here. The third comment is that science, when it comes down to it, is a vocation. It's my vocation. And we have obligations to honor God and bring people together, as with any vocation. At the height of the Cold War, one of the warmest areas of collaboration between the United States and the Soviet Union was through planetary science. And as I noted before, there's something about the grandeur of planetary science that encourages a perspective beyond the daily trappings of a self-centered life. Finally, I can take joy in the natural world because of my faith, like John Pratt did. Much has been written throughout history to this end, but I wanted to share one particular poetic translation from St. Augustine's Confessions. God planted love in my heart, but what is the object of my love? I asked the earth, and it answered, I am not he. And all the things that are in the earth made the same confession. I asked the sea and the depths and the creeping things, and they answered, we are not your God, seek higher. I asked the winds that blow, and the whole air with all that is in it answered, Anaximenes was wrong, I am not God. I asked the heavens, the sun, the moon, the stars, and they answered, neither are we God whom you seek. And I said to all the things that throng about the gateways of the senses, tell me of my God, since you are not he. Tell me something of him. And they cried out in a great voice, he made us. My question was my gazing upon them, and their answer was their beauty. I asked the whole frame of the universe about my God, and it answered me, I am not he, but he made me. So for me, this field is just really cool. The universe is intricate and huge, and obviously its creator has to be even bigger. And searching this out is a privileged endeavor. Thank you. Yeah, areas of higher elevation, and on Earth, continents are the areas where there's really thick crust, and that's the same on Venus. So there's a little bit of a parallel, but obviously it's very different because Venus doesn't have plate tectonics. So it's not really continents in the way that we think of continents. One of the things about Venus is that it doesn't have a lot of craters. So that lead scientists to believe that Venus is younger, or the present surface is younger than the moon. And moreover, the craters are distributed more or less randomly on the surface. So some might be older than others, but we can't really tell. So the whole surface of the Venus, as far as we could tell, is more or less the same age. And there might be some areas, like the continents themselves might be a little bit older, but there just isn't enough statistics with craters to tell that.
You may have answered this. You talked about how the hydrogen's been blown off by the solar wind. How is it held on to so much of the heavier gases?
Well, the heavier gases are more massive, and so it's more difficult to eject a carbon dioxide molecule than a hydrogen or helium atom. So there's this fractionation where all of the lightest things have left the atmosphere, but CO2 is one of the major gases that stayed behind.
Do we know how all that got there, since at one time two light reactors do that stuff?
Well, there's a lot of volcanism on Venus, and whenever there's volcanism, there tends to be gases that are spewed out of the inside of the planet. So it probably accumulated, and there was no way to recycle them. And so it just accumulated more and more and more, and then you have this really thick atmosphere.
When it comes to iron cores and magnetic fields, do you think exoplanets are more likely to be like Venus or possibly more like Earth?
That's a good question. We only have a few planets in our solar system that are Earth-like. So we're studying with statistics of very low numbers. Earth has a magnetic field, Venus doesn't. We're not sure if one or the other is an anomaly. Earth has plate tectonics and Venus doesn't, and it's not really clear which of them is the anomaly. But it's easier to get a magnetic field if there's greater heat flux coming out of the planet. So if there is, that's something that creates convection cells in the core of the planet. So if you facilitate this heat flux, like with plate tectonics, where continents are, or oceanic crust is recycled downward and you get new crust forming, that's a very efficient way to transport heat out from the center of the planet. And so that could be why Earth has a magnetic field.
Okay, let's do one more. Question.
Yes. Are there other observations or experiments that could be done that would come in a different direction and help corroborate your hypothesis and your findings?
About the continents?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you can. A lot of the studies that have been done have been looking at tectonic features. So there are these features called ribbons, and there are generations of these, and scientists, geologists have worked very hard, and this is a very heated debate before my time, about which of these layers of expansion and contraction is the original one. And so that's something that you would expect with a downwelling. There would be a lot of compression versus an upwelling. There would be a little bit of both. So that's one way to look at this problem. And so far, it's ended in stalemate. But I think looking into the mantle gives a new piece of information about this.